The chair does not intend to recognize members to direct questions to the staff during the briefing. The chair now recognizes for up to an hour, Mr. Shippers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before you start, Mr. Shippers, Mr. Schumer can make the unanimous consent.
Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent that this letter, which I guess was of September 25th from Kenneth Starr to you and Mr. Conyers, be able to be used in this hearing.
Be considered in open session, although it is appropriately executive session material.
Although
without objection, so ordered. You bet. Mr. Shippers.
I'll not let you put any other words in my mouth, Mr. Chairman. Not today, anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pull the microphone a little closer to you and so we can hear you.
Members of the committee, as the chief investigative counsel for the majority, I've been called upon to advise the Judiciary Committee of the results of our analysis and review of the September 9, 1998 referral from the Office of the Independent Counsel, in which there was a conclusion that there is substantial and credible information that President William Jefferson Clinton committed acts that may constitute grounds for an impeachment.
Mr. Shippers, would you pull the mic a little closer to you? It's not coming.
How's that? That's a little better? All right.
Much better.
In executing the task assigned to us, my staff and I have made a deliberate effort to discount the political aspects of our examination and to ignore any partisan tactics or strategy. The standard of review was set by me in our very first meeting after the delivery of the material. I reminded the staff that we are not advocates, that we are professionals asked to perform a professional, albeit distasteful, duty. Therefore, I asked them to review the referral and supporting data in the light most favorable to the President. Throughout this effort, we have been determined to avoid even the suggestion of preference because we view our responsibility as requiring an unbiased, full, and expeditious review, untrammeled by any preconceived notions or opinions. Our approach has been solely in keeping with constitutional and legal standards of fairness and impartiality. Before moving on to the substantive areas of the report, I would like to address two elementary but basic concepts of our constitutional government. These will serve to put our conclusions in the proper perspective. First, the President of the United States enjoys a singular and appropriately lofty position in our system of government. But that position, by its very nature, involves equally unique and onerous responsibilities, among which are included affirmative obligations that apply to no other citizen. Specifically, the Constitution of the United States imposes upon the President the explicit and affirmative duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Moreover, before entering upon the duties of his office, the President is constitutionally commanded to take the following oath. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. The President, then, is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Although he is neither above nor below the law, he is, by virtue of his office, held to a higher standard than any other American. Furthermore, as chief executive officer and commander-in-chief, he is the repository of a special trust. Second, many defendants who face legal action, whether it be civil or criminal, can honestly believe that the case against them is unwarranted and factually deficient. It is not, however, in the discretion of the litigant to decide that any tactics are justified to defeat the lawsuit in that situation. Rather, it is incumbent upon that individual to testify fully and truthfully during the truth-seeking phase. It is then the function of our system of law to expose the frivolous cases. The litigant may not with impunity mislead, deceive, or lie under oath in order to prevail in the lawsuit or for other personal gain. Any other result would be subversive of the American rule of law. The principle that every witness in every case must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, is the foundation of the American system of justice, which is the envy of every civilized nation. The sanctity of the oath taken by a witness is the most essential bulwark of the truth-seeking function of a trial, which is the American method of ascertaining the facts. If lying under oath is tolerated, and when exposed is not visited with immediate and substantial adverse consequences, the integrity of this country's entire judicial process is fatally compromised, and that process will inevitably collapse. The subject matter of the underlying case, whether civil or criminal, and the circumstances under which the testimony is given are of no significance whatever. It is the oath itself that is sacred and must be enforced. The Independent Counsel Act provides in relevant part that an independent counsel shall advise the House of Representatives of any substantial and credible information that may constitute grounds for an impeachment. In compliance with the statutory mandate, the Office of the Independent Counsel, Kenneth Starr, informed the House of Representatives on September 9, 1998, that it was prepared to submit a referral under that statute. On that day, the Independent Counsel's Office delivered to the House the following material. A referral consisting of an introduction, a narrative of relevant events, and an identification and analysis of the substantial and credible information that may support grounds for impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton. B, an appendix in 6 3-ring binders, totaling in excess of 2,500 pages of the most relevant testimony and other material cited in the referral. And C, 17 transmittal boxes containing grand jury transcripts, deposition transcripts, FBI reports, reports of interviews, and thousands of pages of incidental backup documents. Pursuant to House Resolution 525, all of this material was turned over to the Committee on the Judiciary to be held in executive session until September 28, 1998. And at that time, the House ordered that all materials be released to the public except those which were withheld by action of the committee. My staff and the minority staff were then instructed by the committee to review the referral together with all of the other evidence and testimony that had been submitted for the purpose of determining whether there actually existed substantial and credible evidence that President William Jefferson Clinton may have committed acts that may constitute grounds to proceed to a resolution for an impeachment inquiry. Because of the narrow scope of our directive, the investigation and analysis was necessarily circumscribed by the information delivered with the referral. We also considered some information and analysis that was furnished by the counsel for the president. For that reason, we did not seek to procure any additional evidence or testimony from any other source. Particularly, we did not seek to obtain or review the material that remained in the possession of the Office of Independent Counsel. In two telephone conversations with Mr. Bittman, Mr. Lowell and I were assured that the retained material was deemed unnecessary to comply with the statutory requirement under Section 595C. Though Mr. Bittman offered to make available to both counsel all of the material, my staff and I did not deem it necessary, or for that matter, even proper, to go beyond the submission itself. At the suggestion of the minority counsel, the retained material was later reviewed by members of both staffs. The material was, as anticipated, irrelevant. To support the referral, the House has been furnished with grand jury transcripts, FBI interview memoranda, transcripts of depositions, other interview memoranda, statements, audio recordings, and, where available, video recordings of all persons named in the referral. In addition, the House was provided with a copy of every document cited and a mass of documentary and other evidence produced by witnesses, the White House, the President, the Secret Service, and the Department of Defense. This report is confined solely to that referral and supporting evidence and the testimony supplied to the House and then to this committee, supplemented only by the information provided by the President's counsel. Although the original submission contained a transcript of the President's deposition testimony, no videotape was included. Pursuant to a request by Chairman Hyde, a videotape of the entire deposition was later provided to the committee by the district judge. Both that video and the video of the President's testimony before the grand jury have been thoroughly reviewed by all members of my staff and by me personally. Apart from the thorough review of President Clinton's deposition and grand jury testimony, the following functions were also performed in preparation for this report. All grand jury transcripts and memoranda of interview of Ms. Curry, Mr. Jordan, Ms. Lewinsky, the Secret Service agents, and Ms. Tripp were independently reviewed, compared, and analyzed by at least three members of my staff. And those of Ms. Curry, Mr. Jordan, Ms. Lewinsky, Ms. Tripp, and both appearances of the President by me personally. All of the remaining grand jury transcripts, deposition transcripts, and memoranda of the others interviewed were likewise reviewed, compared, and analyzed. This involved more than 250 separate documents, some consisting of hundreds of pages. In this regard, my staff was instructed to seek any information that might cast doubt upon the legal or factual conclusions of the independent counsel. The entire appendix, consisting of in excess of 2,000 pages, was systematically reviewed and analyzed against the statements contained in the referral. I personally read the entire evidence reference and legal reference that accompanied the referral. I analyzed the legal precepts and the theories and read at least the relevant portions of every case cited. In addition to other members of the staff, I personally read and analyzed the 11 specific allegations made by the independent counsel, and I also reviewed the evidentiary basis for those allegations. Each footnote supporting the charges was checked to ensure that it did, in fact, support the underlying evidentiary proposition. In cases where inferences were drawn in the body of the referral, the validity of those inferences was tested under acceptable principles of federal trial practice. Each of the literally thousands of backup documents was reviewed in order to ensure that no relevant evidence had been overlooked. Meetings of the entire staff were held virtually on a daily basis for the purpose of coordinating our efforts and to synthesize the divergent material into a coherent report. Having completed all of those tasks assigned to us, we are now prepared to report our findings to you, the members of this committee. We are fully aware that the purpose of this hearing is solely for the committee to decide whether there is sufficient, credible, and substantial evidence to proceed to an impeachment inquiry. This and nothing more. Of course, as members of this committee, you and only you are authorized and encouraged eventually to make your own independent judgment on what constitutes impeachable offenses and the standards of proof that might be applicable. My report then represents only a distillation and consensus of the staff's efforts and conclusions for your guidance and consideration. At the outset, one point needs to be made. The witness Monica Lewinsky's credibility may be subject to some skepticism. At an appropriate stage of the proceedings, that credibility will of necessity be assessed together with the credibility of all other witnesses in the light of all the other evidence. Ms. Lewinsky admitted to having lied on occasion to Ms. Tripp, and she also admitted to having executed and caused to be filed a false affidavit in the Paula Jones case. On the other hand, Ms. Lewinsky obtained a grant of immunity for her testimony before the grand jury and therefore has no reason to lie thereafter. Furthermore, the witness's account of the relevant events could well have been much more damaging. For the most part, though, the record reflects that she was an embarrassed and reluctant witness who actually downplayed her White House encounters. In testifying, Ms. Lewinsky demonstrated a remarkable memory supported by her personal diary concerning dates and events. Finally, the record includes ample corroboration of her testimony by independent and disinterested witnesses, by documentary evidence, and in part by the grand jury testimony of the president himself. Consequently, for the limited purpose of this report, we suggest that Monica Lewinsky's testimony is both substantial and credible. It has been the considered judgment of my staff and myself that our main focus should be on those alleged acts and omissions by the president which affect the rule of law and the structure and integrity of our court system. Deplorable as the numerous sexual encounters related in the evidence may be, we chose to emphasize the consequences of those acts as they affect the administration of justice and the unique role the president occupies in carrying out his oath faithfully to execute the laws of the nation. The prurient aspect of the referral is, at best, merely peripheral to the central issues. The assertions of presidential misconduct cited in the referral, though arising initially out of sexual indiscretions, are completely distinct and involve allegations of an ongoing series of deliberate and direct assaults by Mr. Clinton upon the justice system of the United States and upon the judicial branch of our government, which holds a place in the constitutional framework of checks and balances equal to that of the executive and the legislative branches. As a result of our research and review of the referral and supporting documentation, we respectfully submit that there exists substantial and credible evidence of 15 separate events directly involving President William Jefferson Clinton that could constitute felonies, which in turn may constitute grounds to proceed with an impeachment inquiry. I will now present the catalog of those charges, together with a brief statement of the evidence supporting each. Please understand that nothing contained in this report is intended to constitute an accusation against the president or anyone else. And it should not be construed as such by anyone. What follows is nothing more than a litany of the crimes that might have been committed based upon the substantial and credible evidence provided by the independent counsel and reviewed, tested, and analyzed by my staff. With that caution in mind, I will proceed. First, there is substantial and credible evidence that the President may have been part of a conspiracy with Monica Lewinsky and others to obstruct justice and the due administration of justice by A, providing false and misleading testimony under oath in a civil deposition and before the grand jury, B, withholding evidence and causing evidence to be withheld and concealed, and C, tampering with prospective witnesses in a civil lawsuit and before a federal grand jury. The President and Ms. Lewinsky had developed a cover story to conceal their activities. On December 6, 1997, the President learned that Ms. Lewinsky's name had appeared on the Jones versus Clinton witness list. He informed Ms. Lewinsky of that fact on December 17, 1997, and the two agreed that they would employ the same cover story in the Jones case. The President at that time suggested that an affidavit might be enough to prevent Ms. Lewinsky from testifying. On December 19, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky was subpoenaed to give a deposition in the Jones case. Thereafter, the record tends to establish that the following events took place. One, in the second week of December 1997, Ms. Lewinsky told Ms. Tripp that she would lie if called to testify and tried to convince Ms. Tripp to do the same. Two, Ms. Lewinsky attempted on several occasions to get Ms. Tripp to contact the White House before giving testimony in the Jones case. Three, Ms. Lewinsky participated in preparing a false and intentionally misleading affidavit to be filed in the Jones case. Four, Ms. Lewinsky provided a copy of the draft affidavit to a third party for approval and discussed changes calculated to mislead. Five, Ms. Lewinsky and the President talked by phone on January 6, 1998, and agreed that she would give false and misleading answers to questions about her job at the Pentagon. Six, on January 7, 1998, Ms. Lewinsky signed the false and misleading affidavit. The conspirators intended to use the affidavit to avoid Ms. Lewinsky's giving testimony. Seven, after Ms. Lewinsky's name surfaced, the conspirators began to employ code names in their contacts. Eight, on December 28, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky and the President met at the White House and discussed the subpoena she had received. Ms. Lewinsky suggested that she conceal the gifts that she'd received from the President. Shortly thereafter, the President's personal secretary, Betty Curry, picked up a box of the gifts from Ms. Lewinsky. 10, Betty Curry hid that box of gifts under her bed at home. 11, the President gave false and evasive answers to questions contained in interrogatories in the Jones case. 12, on December 31, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky, at the suggestion of a third party, deleted 50 draft notes that she'd made up to the President. She had already been subpoenaed to testify in the Jones case. 13, on January 17, 1998, the President's attorney produced Ms. Lewinsky's false affidavit at the President's deposition, and the President adopted it as true. 14, on January 17, 1998, in his deposition, the President gave false and misleading testimony under oath concerning his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, about the gifts she had given him, and several other matters. 15, the President on January 18, 1998 and thereafter coached his personal secretary, Betty Curry, to give a false and misleading account of the Lewinsky relationship if called to testify. 16, the President narrated elaborate, detailed false accounts of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky to prospective witnesses with the intention that those false accounts would be repeated in testimony. 17, on August 17, 1998, the President gave false and misleading testimony under oath to a federal grand jury on the following points: his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, his testimony in the January 17, 1998 deposition, his conversations with various individuals, and his knowledge of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit and its falsity. At this point, I would like to illustrate some of the details concerning the events immediately before and after the President's deposition on January 17, 19. The President and Vernon Jordan exchanged 3 telephone calls. The President also called Betty Curry and asked her to meet with him in the Oval Office on the following day. On Sunday, January 18th, at a little after 6 o'clock in the morning, the President learned of the existence of the Linda Tripp tapes through an article in the Drudge Report. At 11:49 a.m., Vernon Jordan telephones the White House, and within 40 minutes, he meets White House counsel Bruce Lindsay for lunch. At approximately 1 p.m., the President calls both Vernon Jordan and Betty Curry at their homes. Between 2:15 and 2:55, the records show that Vernon Jordan placed 1 call to the White House and 1 call to the President himself. And at 5 o'clock, the President meets with Betty Curry. In that meeting, the President informs Ms. Curry that he had been questioned at his deposition about Monica Lewinsky. During the next 3 hours and 16 minutes, Betty Curry places 4 pages to Monica Lewinsky's pager, requesting that Monica call Kay, a previously agreed upon code name that was being used by Ms. Curry and Ms. Lewinsky. At 10:09 p.m., Monica Lewinsky finally telephoned Betty Curry at home. She told Betty Curry that she was not in a position to be able to talk, but that she would call back later. At 11:02 p.m., the President telephoned Betty Curry at home as well. That evening, Vernon Jordan called Deputy White House Counsel Cheryl Mills. Although the following day, January 19, 1998, was a national holiday honoring Martin Luther King Jr., the flurry of activity continued. Between 7:02 and 8:33 a.m., Betty Curry places 3 pages to Monica Lewinsky's, instructing her to, quote, please call Kay. When Ms. Curry receives no response, she places another page 4 minutes later stating, please call Kay at home. It's a social call. Thank you. 4 minutes after that page, Ms. Curry pages Monica again with the message, Kay is at home. Please call. Ms. Curry received no response to either of those pages or any. 2 minutes later, Betty Curry telephones the President from her home. Immediately following her phone call to the President, Ms. Curry places another page to Ms. Lewinsky, telling her to please call Kate Ray, family emergency. At 8:50 a.m., 6 minutes later, the President calls Ms. Curry at home. Immediately after the phone call from the President, Ms. Curry once again pages Monica and states, message from Kay, please call, have good news. 6 minutes after the President calls Ms. Curry at her home, he places a call to Vernon Jordan at his home. During a 24-minute span from 10:29 to 10:53 a.m., Vernon Jordan places 5 calls. 3 of those calls are placed to the White House, one of which is to Deputy Assistant to the President, Nancy Henrich, and 1 to White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles. Mr. Jordan also pages Monica Lewinsky, instructing her to call him at his office. Mr. Jordan's final call in this time period is to Ms. Lewinsky's attorney, Frank Carter. After Mr. Jordan concludes his call to Mr. Carter, he receives a phone call from the President. Between 11:04 and 11:17 a.m., Vernon Jordan places 2 calls to Deputy White House Counsel Bruce Lindsay. Mr. Jordan again pages Monica Lewinsky with the message, please call Mr. Jordan. At 12:31 p.m., Mr. Jordan uses his cellular phone to once again contact the White House. At 1:45 p.m., the President telephones Betty Curry at home. At 2:29 p.m., Vernon Jordan again telephones the White House from a cellular phone and then enters the White House 15 minutes later. Once at the White House, Mr. Jordan meets with President Clinton, Erskine Bowles, Bruce Lindsay, Cheryl Mills, White House Counsel Charles Ruff, Rahm Emanuel, and others. At 2:46 p.m., Frank Carter pages Monica Lewinsky and requests her to please call Frank Carter. Beginning at 4:51 p.m., the next 1 hour and 4 minutes show Vernon Jordan placing 14 calls. Six of those calls are to Bruce Lindsay, three are to Frank Carter, two are to Cheryl Mills, one is to Charles Ruff, and two are to Betty Curry. At 5:56 p.m., the president telephones Vernon Jordan at his office. 8 minutes later, Mr. Jordan telephones Betty Curry at her home. Finally, at 6:26 p.m., Vernon Jordan telephones presidential aide Stephen Gooden. Thank you.